Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to On the Dean's List, a podcast that celebrates the art of conversation with your host, Dean Latticer.
Thank you, George. Good morning, everyone. You are on the Dean's List. I'm your host, Dean Latticer, here where we celebrate the art of conversation, talking about communications, marketing, media, and more. And I've got to tell you, this morning's guest is uniquely qualified to talk about all those things and more. He was an award-winning journalist. He's a broadcaster. He's a blogger. He's a maniac, actually, and as I put on one of the promos, he's going to give us his takes on the free world, eavesdrop if you dare. So Jim McFarlane, Jim is most known, at least around these parts, as a contributor to the Metro Times. He was the media columnist for a gazillion years there when the Detroit News was worth reading. I didn't say that, did I? And he's just a lot of fun, and so he and I on the pre-call were just having too much fun. So I think we're going to let you eavesdrop if you dare. I put probably too extensive a bio on him, but how do you encapsulize this man? We're going to talk about everything from the presidential election to media to his love of the English language and why we need to respect it. So we call this episode The Return of the Word Grouch. So let's give a warm on the Dean's List welcome to my friend and his, Jim McFarlane. Good morning, Jimmy.
I can't wait to hear this guy. He sounds amazing. Good morning, Dean. How are you?
He has his days, but for everybody listening, this next half hour is going to be two guys trying to crack each other up and let you, it's kind of like you're sitting at the coffee table and they're playing Can You Top This? So prepare to go for a roller coaster ride and strap it on, baby. How you doing? I mean, it's been a little over a year since we last talked on the air anyways.
Has it really? Oh, my gosh, that flew fast. Because I remember our conversation on the Dean's List as if it were a week and a half ago.
You were the first one on a new platform I tried, but it didn't work. So I'm back on Blog Talk Radio. Actually, I'll probably be porting that show over on it. I had a bunch of stuff on. I had my own domain and stuff like that. I was king of my own domain. Mm-hmm. It didn't last.
Ah, it's a beautiful place to be. But, yeah, it's hard.
Well,
hard to maintain.
We're sitting here. We're in the midst of a presidential campaign right now. And, you know, last night was the New York primary, so that'll kind of date it. But tell you what, why don't you tell me what you see on this 2016 race so far, and what do you think of what's going on here?
Well, you know, I've been terrified about this whole campaign since it began because at least in my memories, it is the lesser of all evil. There is no great outstanding choice here that makes you say, this is the person I want to lead the greatest country in the free world for the next 4 years. I'm scared, Dean. I think that there's going to be a real, I don't want to say riot, even though Trump keeps suggesting it's going to be Cleveland's going to burn at the Republican National Convention.
I don't think Mr. Gilbert will appreciate them burning down his arena.
I agree with you, but have you heard that not only you saying, I don't want to say it'll be violence, I don't want to suggest it'll be violence, you say that often enough, you know, you're the guy who's like ringing the bell, oh my goodness, there's violence, who knew this could happen? There's a real good chance, and I said this at the outset, I told my wife, I said, not in my recollection has someone with this much money, most rich people don't want to be president because it's just a pain in the butt, they'd rather make money. But I don't remember anybody who could independently say, I'm going to run my own campaign, I'm going to finance my own campaign, I don't need tax, I don't need outside money, I'm going to do it myself. Someone who's not beholden to anybody is almost more dangerous than someone who is because he can do anything he wants. And I said, don't be surprised if this guy wins the election. Don't be surprised if it's President Trump come 2017. And I say that because we as a society have become so celebrity and personality driven. I compared it, and it's a horrible comparison, but I compared it to Martha Reeves becoming a Detroit City Council person. Martha Reeves can't spell council person, but people got in that movie and they closed the door and they said, I know that name. Hey, that's Martha Reeves. She sure could sing. Let's vote for her. And that same mentality could very easily carry over into the presidential race. I mean,
I loved Donald. When I was going for my master's of business administration, I used to love to watch The Apprentice and watch people screw things up or watch people think their cult of personality would get the task done. I mean, it was battling egos, and I'm sitting there learning project management, and I'm learning these things, and I'm just sitting there. It was like watching a Looney Tunes version of your MBA, and it was really incredible. I mean, my favorite one was one of the Jonas Brothers was going head-to-head against Geraldo Rivera, and I'm thinking, Don likes Rivera. There's no way he's sending him home this early in the game. I mean, the cards were stacked, so.
Well, he was great television. Yeah, you can't. It's all about ratings the other day, as it is in this race. I think that the RNC realizes they made a terrible mistake, that they should have thwarted him much earlier. He's got momentum now, and now it makes it look, anything that the committee does, the national committee does, makes it look like they have a vendetta against him. So they kind of have to let this whole thing run its course. And so, do I think Hillary Clinton can beat him in a general election? I think she can. I really hope she can, not because I'm a big Hillary supporter, but I think she is the lesser of two evils. I really do. And we may end up with that. I don't think, you know, I would love to see Bernie come through. I don't think there's a snowflake chance that Bernie Sanders could be the next president. But given what the frontrunners have to offer, and given the Antichrist, Ted Cruz lurking in the shadows, I don't see any viable candidate that makes me say, this makes me feel so confident and sanguine about the future of our nation. That's not happening. And this is a terrible analogy. I know that I named names, but there was a time in 1930s Germany where the same kind of mentality was going on. They were discouraged and disillusioned with the present politics. They felt like they'd been abused as a nation. They felt like they weren't number one anymore. The other countries were out ahead of them. And this guy came out of nowhere, and all he basically said, he had no great agenda. He had no specific policy. All he said was, I'm going to make Germany great again. He kept saying it. People said, hey, let's go with this guy. He says he'll make Germany great again. Well, I see a parallel here. And I don't see, and I'm not saying, and it's going to be the same. I'm just saying.
No, and you also aren't the first one to say that. I mean, I agree with you that the Don is short on specifics and long on passion and emotion, and that does also concern me. And some of the piece, but when I put it up, like on my own social media, I don't know if you saw, I put a piece on what it would really cost in terms of dollars, logistics, and skills to build that wall between Mexico and the southern United States border. And a lot of people said, so, like you know, but still, such a great idea. You know, I mean, curing cement in a hot sun and you know, these are people who figured out how to get in. If Western Union isn't there to take their wire transfer, these are people who will find a way to get that money, not just to Mexico, because, again, it's also other Central American countries. These are not stupid people. One of the key players I see in our elections, Fox News Network, helmed by Roger Ailes, conservative, on that. And, you know, one of the things about it, and I want to get your take because you're an insider, you know, one of the things conservatives always rail about liberal media, liberal media, liberal media. Do you really think the media is all that liberal?
I really don't. I think that a lot of people who run the media are not liberal. I think that the tenor of our society suggests that many voices need to be heard. I think that, you know, there was the big Jewish conspiracy, and then there was I've even heard about the African-American conspiracy. You know what I mean? People who are not behind the curtain, people who are not within the seat of power or at the big table, they always suspect that someone else is doing something they can't do. It's not, the reason I can't get in is because of the conservatives. It's because of the Jews. It's because of the blacks. It's because of the Asians. Somebody's controlling something I can't get in, which is another way of saying I really either am frustrated or don't have a lot of talent. But I have never considered, I mean, having worked for
did you ever sit in a newsroom And you work for the more conservative paper here in Metro Detroit. You know, the news has always been more of the right in terms of their editorial policy, more
right.
in terms of the stance it would take. Did anybody ever look at you and say, well, you know, Jim, you know, we need to champion business and industry here. We are their friend. Any editor or anybody ever come up to you and say, you know, you're the news. You're supposed to be taking that side of the story.
Well, you know, Dean, it was funny. When I worked for the news as an African-American man, I ran into countless people who could not believe I worked for the Detroit News. They couldn't imagine the paper in that era back in, like, the 70s, 80s, actually hiring a black person. They would all work for
really?
It. You have to work for the. You have to work for the Free Press. You can't work for the news. The news would hire a black person. I mean, there was that kind of that stigma, that kind of whole image that goes, you know, they're so conservative. They're to the right of Attila the Hun. The news just is so straight and so. And the Free Press had built this image of being very left wing and happy and liberal. And I mean, the lines of demarcation back in the day were so clearly defined that most people in Detroit could not see any kind of overlap. But I must, to answer your question specifically, I never, ever was in a production meeting, an editorial meeting. I did a lot of features, so I wasn't really on the hard news side a lot. But there were times when music and entertainment became hard news. I never heard an editor say, we need to uphold or support the conservative agenda in Detroit. We need to make sure that the Republican voice or the ultra-conservative, that doesn't happen. At the end of the day, newspaper people, radio people, TV people are basically people. And some have biases, some don't. Most people just want to get their job done, put in their 8, 10, 12 hours and go home to see their spouse, pet the kid, eat the food and go to bed. I mean, they don't, you know, they're not in some cabal somewhere trying to figure out the next greatest stuff they're going to have on society. They're just working stiffs like you and me. They just want to do their jobs, do it the best they can, not get fired, not get yelled at, and go home. Well, basically, life, even as an adult, is just like being in kindergarten. You want to play with others well, not get yelled at, and get to go home. If you do those three things every day, then life is good. It has nothing to do with your conservative liberal agenda. It's just a job.
Let me give you a chance to offer some analysis here, because I was thinking while we were talking about Fox News, Roger Ailes, and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
that it seems as if that's a very fractured company. You sometimes see some of the most outrageous things on Fox Broadcast Network, and, you know, you see some mm-hmm. of the most conservative, far to the right stuff like that. But I always wondered, if Ailes is so good at this, why don't more local Fox stations take that tact? I mean, we've got a lot of live content here in Detroit. I don't know what it's like where you're at in Illinois. But we got, you know, why wouldn't more local stations say, hey, macro, micro, let's take the big picture here and try to appeal to an audience based upon that, as opposed to, you know, being there first with the fire or stuff like that?
Mm-hmm. I don't have an answer for that, Dean, unfortunately. I think that you know, obviously Fox, the company, loves Fox 2 in Detroit because their whole broadcast day is turned over to local news and local programming, and that means they're going to make local money, which funnels to the headquarters in New York City. That makes them happy. But why other stations in the chain? Yeah, a lot of it has to do with autonomy. You don't really running a network is a very delicate dance. You know, you want to have your input. You want to have your imprint on what the network does, but you don't want to be so autocratic that people say, well, why am I even here? You know, why did you even bother to hire me? If you're going to run the ship from New York anyway, just am I here just to play golf or what? We got something for me to do? Because, I mean, people want to work. And they don't want to be – we don't mind being told what to do, but not to the extent where we have nothing to do because you're doing it all. So I don't know why you don't see other Fox stations on the market. Certainly the Fox station here where I live outside of Chicago doesn't reflect – looks nothing like the Fox station in Detroit. So why there is no consistency, why there is no kind of large imprint, you would expect all Fox stations to look like Fox News in a sense. I mean, if Fox News is the imprimatur that they want, then why don't Fox stations look like that? Because
you look at a CBS O&O, or you look at an ABC O&O, which we had here in Detroit, and there was that kind of there was that kind of standing in each other's shadow on it. But I thought I'd ask the question. You know, you're a radio guy. I'm a radio guy at heart, and this is kind of a seg into that. I mean, one of the things I've put on my smartphone is I'm following the stock prices on iHeart and Cumulus and stuff like that. And you just see the implosion of these. I mean, these are heavily debt-ridden companies. iHeart's right about $1 a share. Cumulus, WJR, its parent company, they're plus or minus 50 cents. I mean, they're a penny. These are penny stocks. And yet, Les Moonves over at CBS says that he's willing to float his station group, the thing that was William Pauly's pride, the reason he left the cigar store business and got into broadcasting was radio. And he's willing to float them and put them on the block. Jim, can you wipe some fingerprints off your crystal ball and tell us what you see the future of radio as?
It's not pleasant, Gene. And for those of us like you who both admire the medium and have been part of it, it's kind of heartbreaking. But I think change is inevitable. I think that when you have the emergence of things like satellite radio and iHeartRadio and all those other platforms, that terrestrial radio, I don't see a future in it. I just don't see how it can survive. It's hanging on. I mean, there are still some broadcast groups, like you suggest, not a lot of them are making a whole pile of money. And it's become harder and harder to convince advertisers that they need to make radio part of their broadcast pie, that you need to have have a solid presence on your local radio station. There is a station here where I live that just makes me smile because it's the local news and talk station, and it's just so darn folksy. It's like it's as if Barney Fife was running the station. It's just, there's an old guy who's been around since he must be at least 116 years old. He's on the air every day at 10 in the morning. And he just talks to this bunch of crazy farmers and business people and we're in a little microcosm. That's so rare. Radio used to have a great...
Bob Allison's still buying time on a station trying to do the same shtick, him and his son. But.
Yeah. Yeah. And how old is Bob? Like 85 by now. He's like 90.
I think he was in the same graduating high school class as Marconi. I'm not really sure, but.
and thus, a business was born, yes. They should have.
That's right.
Love it, honey.
I'm concerned. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, looking at Peggy Allison's case, that's the thing, too. I remember Arthur Stenhouse told me years ago. He wanted desperately to go back to Hawaii and spend his golden years there in broadcasting semi-retirement. But he could never go because people wouldn't pay him what he thought he was worth. They had to pay. It was like sunshine and surf. You're coming to this wonderland, but you're going to cut your salary because you're in Hawaii. How am I going to be? It's much the same way. Once you're in the business, it's in your heart. It's hard to get out. You have people who are like doing really great morning shows or really, really successful, who are still, now they're working for some station in Potosi and, doing like the overnight shift, because once broadcasting gets in your blood, it's hard to get out. And that's
I think Jimmy Barrett is the greatest example of that. WJR strung along and, I've kind of penciled him in I don't think he's ever told his side of what happened when he was filling in that gap between JP and Paul W.
And Paul W.
And I do want to throw one thought at you. One of the things is there's only so much bandwidth and spectrum. I really think a lot of these highly leveraged I think somebody's going to look at a Bob Pittman and say, you know what? We don't care whether it's a country, a talk, or an all-hit format. We want your frequency. We want your bandwidth. You've got seven stations in the market. Sell us one like a Verizon or a T-Mobile or something like that. Because there's only so much bandwidth available. That's my concern. What's going to kill radio is not the is not bad programming or being broadcast audio cable TV, but there's only so much bandwidth, so people are going to take it and convert it into, Wi-Fi or stuff like that.
Yeah. That's an interesting thought. I had not occurred to me before that might happen. But, yeah, at this state of the game, anything's possible. I think what really, the beginning of the end for radio was what you just touched on, single ownership of multiple stations in the same market. How can you possibly expect competition to rule the day, to lift all the boats higher if one guy or one company owns seven stations in a market? You just eliminated about 100 jobs because you got people who can do the same job at six different stations, so you don't need six different people. And that, to me, was like, where's the competition? You know, you put on a good station and say, well, this country station is going to... But when you own both the country stations in the market, one modern country and one traditional country, how can you possibly expect to put on a straight face? We're fighting each other, truth and nail. So you really were fighting when stations really did compete against each other and raided each other and took talent and salespeople and behind-the-scenes folks to make their stations better. That's when radio was really radio. That's when it really thrived. And now it's just kind of languishing because there's no incentive anymore for stations to really go out and beat each other's brains out like they did back in the golden age, if you will, back in like the 70s and 80s.
I want to make sure I get something in here. I'm looking at the clock, and it's moving faster, and being a radio guy, you watch the clock. One of the things, and I call this episode Return of the Word Grouch, because both your Twitter handle and your passion for the standard language, and you go out and talk about this, and I think it's important that writers talk about the art and science of our craft, and that's one of the things I want to make sure that you hit on here before I let you go. Okay, Word Grouch, I'm letting you have my platform, my podium. Have at it. Schools, because I have to tell you, I think our biggest competition is a lot of people's ego. Hey, I've got a college degree. I took a comp class, or I took, you know what? I took Intro to Journalism 201. I know what a lead is, and they couldn't lead a horse to water, let alone make it drink.
Well, I was part of a fascinating exercise a couple of weeks ago. One of the adjunct professors at Wayne State University in Detroit invited a number of writers, and I don't want to say successful because I was invited too, but people who are actually making a living writing to talk to their journalism students via Twitter chat. And it's intense. I'd never done it like that before while I was being the person interviewed. But you got questions flying from, dozens of different directions trying to cover as much as you can. But what made me happy about that was that there are still young people in the world who see writing and journalism and communication with the written word as a viable resource, a viable avenue to make a living. And sometimes with everything else, with the emoticons and LOLs and all that, sometimes you forget that there are actually still people in the world who think writing is an art worth defending. Someone asked me the other day, how are we going to write biographies in the future when no one writes letters? Because so many of the books that have been great, there'd be no Diary of Anne Frank if Anne Frank had a smartphone, because she'd be texting everybody. And now we have very few areas these days where we, possess and keep and hold written documents that give you a tenor of the time and the people and the places.
I agree, but I'm standing looking at two grocery bags full of papers and printouts and stuff like that. I think some of it has shifted into the individual person's hand. It's part of the PDF-ification of our writing. But trust me, Jim, I've got two brown paper bags with Meyer in front of me telling me that, no, I print things out and there is hard copy and I've got an overflowing trash can over here that's confirming that there will be stuff for archaeologists to find.
Well, that gives me hope for the future, Dean. Thank you. I feel
good. Oh, you're welcome.
But to answer your question, I was talking to my book client. I'm in the process of ghostwriting a book right now, and this is a guy who is not prone to flowery language. In the middle of our conversation, he used the word vainglorious, and he used it correctly and in context. And I think everybody else in the conference call just stopped and went, "He used a multi-syllable word," and it was great. I wish that was not the exception. I wish that was the rule. I wish that we all had such a command of our own language that we could communicate and say specifically what we wanted to. So that's what makes words important, Dean, is that we need to. There needs to be no ambiguity, no obfuscation in what we say. We need to say what we mean and mean exactly what we say. And we've been blessed with a language that basically steals from so many other different languages that we can create words or sentences that say precisely what we want to say. And my wife and I teach an English as a second language class at our church on Sunday morning. And we get people from China and from Japan and Korea and Iran and just a wide variety of countries. And we talk often about specificity of language. You know, you can say what you want. This will get you through, but this word is so much better, and this is different than this. And then when you see someone from Korea trying to talk to someone from Ukraine in English and communicate back and forth, you begin to realize how tricky and difficult and specific our language is. And
English embraces a lot of different languages. I mean, we are basically word whores. We appropriate everything. And I think one of the challenges is if you're in that idiomatic speech, the ability to put things in phrases or cliches or stuff like that, you know, the one thing every immigrant seems to be able to say is F you. it just becomes that way. I mean, because that's the lowest common denominator thing, Jim.
Right.
But golly, the phrases, the cliches. If I say to you, "Hey, we're going to knock this out," does that, you know, that means to me we're going to do it with some passion and some enthusiasm and some energy. But it doesn't mean that I'm going to physically strike this thing. And I think that's one of the tricky parts of the English language, is that the true context and the subcontext sometimes have never been formally introduced to each other.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that we've done whole classes just based on idioms, and it's amazing to me because, you know, we're in the battle every day. We're in the milieu, so we don't see it as clearly. But when you say something like that we're going to knock something out to someone from Russia, they strictly think of it as going to ball for fifth and fight, you know what I mean? And it makes sense to those of us who are here, but for those people, people who come to this country, and I admire the heck out of it, because I would want to go to Russia and think I could pick up the language, or to China and think I could find the bathroom by myself. So these people come here. Many of them are visiting scholars. I live in a Big Ten university city, so they come here to study. So they ain't no dummies. These people have multiple PhDs, but still, the language, they know the words, but the idioms just destroy them because they don't have context. They have no idea where it came from, what it means, what the origin was, and why you say this when you mean that. And I find, again, as someone who just has always been fascinated by words and their uses, I find that looking through the eyes of people who are not native-born, trying to understand not so much our language, but what we do when we bend and twist the language and make new phrases out of what should be words that mean something else, I find that fascinating.
Well, but there's also the regionality of it. Jason Carr, he's still at Fox 2 for the moment, he had Bowl of Bacon today. He says, "Say, how do you know you're really from Michigan?" And I said, "Any part of the state that's north of Oakland County is referred to as up north."
Up north, correct.
So, I mean, that's okay. But hey, this is I know I'm talking to a guy from Spring Lake. I gotta watch that stuff.
Where nature's mouth is 7 miles. By the way,
Really? Oh my God! You didn't bring me a wet burrito from the west side? Oh my God! You're killing me.
Oh, I could have bought you a butcher's beef burrito. I have a friend, like my closest friend, we've been buddies since we were in kindergarten together, and that was more than a year or two ago. He's a huge Beatles fan, and his oldest daughter, I think this was just brilliant, his oldest daughter put together a surprise Brent on 64th birthday party, and it was Beatles-themed, and she had created this artwork where her father, as a young mustachioed gentleman, was part of the Fab Four, and you had John Paul, George, Ringo, and my friend. And she had the graphics all over. She made the cake that way. I mean, it was just, she had so much attention to detail. It was just fantastic. But it was, I just thought that, you know, if you have friends who are Beatles fans and they're coming onto a 64th birthday, think about it. Because it was a huge, huge blast. And we all had a wonderful time.
Outstanding, outstanding. Boy, let's go just a few more minutes here. I know we're a little over our 30-minute usual, but hey, this is probably probably last time we're going to really have time to kick it for a while here. Tell you what, I mean, we can talk about, you were talking about a couple of different writing projects. What's on your mind?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you want to get off your chest, vent your spleen, or anything that you want to share that's, you know, the bird tweeting on your shoulder? What's going on in your brain today?
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot, basically, Dean, lately about the process of writing, and I would love to do a book that talks to writers not about what they write, but about how they write. Because I find in my career that I've always had a kind of a fear of either success or failure. I'm not quite sure which from day to day. My personality is not such that it's prone to like being in a small room by myself for hours at a time. But basically, that's what writing entails. I mean, if you're in the middle of a project, yes, there's that whole newsroom phenomenon where you sit in, you know, like a secretarial pool and everybody's got a typewriter and you're all paying away at the same time. But as you get older and you get into longer form projects, you're more likely to be isolated from people for long periods of time. And that I find incredibly frustrating. I communicate. And the thing about writing is it's delayed communication. You know, you haven't read what I'm writing yet. It's really going to be good, I hope, but you haven't seen it yet. And when I get calls from editors or clients or people I've interviewed, they say, "When will the story come out?" I almost want to read it to them at the moment. So, well, it's not going to come out in the magazine for a month and a half, however you like. I'll read the story down. It's just so good, but, you know, I can't do that. To me, there's a lot of frustration in the process of writing. I've never felt real at ease with it in that regard. It's kind of like I know I'm fairly good because people told me over the years I'm fairly good, and I've got like a dozen clients that I'm writing for, so I can't be that bad. And I've got a whole lot who kicked me to the curb, so I'm not as good as I might think I am either. But just the process itself of getting up, what I've found, I usually get up about 3 or 4 in the morning now and write 2 hours every morning before the world wakes up. That's what I found increasingly is that once the day starts and the phone starts ringing and you've got errands to run, oh, my God, I've got a lunch date, pretty soon it's 4:15, 5 o'clock, you haven't done as much as you wanted to do. So I am a night owl by nature. This is one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. But I'm training myself slowly to get up at 0:30 and begin the writing process so at least for a few hours every day I can guarantee myself I can focus on writing. And just do that.
There's one thing I would add on that is that writing is also small motor. Now, you and I being gregarious kind of guys, we are high energy. I'm sure if we were in the same space, our arms would be flailing and people would think either we're trying to land planes or we're the Temptations or something. And just that idea there of being highly animated guys. Writing
right.
is the opposite. It's small motor. It's very much that dialogue, that naked dialogue of your speech, and you're using, you know, I mean, I'm a seven-finger typist, but
mm-hmm.
it still does the job for 55 words a minute. And that ability to capture those small motor ideas and still be flowing and transcendent, and especially
mm-hmm.
when the writing is coming through you, I'm sure, every writer I've talked to has always said there are times that it came through me. I was just basically the funnel, and it appeared
yep.
as nouns and sentences and phrases and paragraphs and gerunds and all that stuff. That idea there of that. So that small motor to large idea, I think, is one of the other parts that I would add to what you just said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the difference between like being a lumberjack and doing little Japanese bonsai trees. You know what I mean? What you do in writing is very small. It's very delicate. Small motor is good. I've not used that phrase before, but I like that. That's exactly.
Well, you got to credit me the first three or four times, then you can use it as your
own. Not a problem. You take it off. Exactly. But yeah, but you're absolutely right. I think I've spoken about it too. Most of the basketball players, or especially basketball players, I guess, will say they get in the zone where it seems like every shot goes in, the basket's 100 foot wide. And the same is true of writers. I think that you long to get to that place where. Yeah, and novels will often say that I create a character, and the character does the work. He talks through me, or she talks through me. I'm just putting the work together. Writers want to get to that space where it's just continuous flow between your mind and your fingertips, and there really is no filter in between. And once you get there, you want to stay there, but it's so ephemeral. You got it for a second, and when this is so much fun, and then it's gone, and you can't get it back. And that's the hard part. The hard part is always searching for to get back to that space, and it's so elusive, and it's so infrequent. But once you're there, in those precious moments when I'm there, Dina, I remember why I write for a living, because that's when it's so much fun. But other times, like most of the time, 85% of the time, it's drudgery, and it's hard. And
it's pushing the boulder up the hill. And preach it, brother, preach it. I understand perfectly what you're saying, and I hope our listeners do too on it. Speaking of, let's talk about a little bit of output. I know you maintain two blogs off and on. I know that you contribute to various publications. Anything in the time remaining, anything we should be looking for? Anything that the assignment gods and the editorial gods have said, Jim, we need some output from you.
I have a piece I just finished that I was so fun to do. It will only be seen, I'm rarely be seen, for you, all, if I ever hang online these days. I did a piece for the Alumni Magazine at Wayne State University on their police department and their police chief, Anthony Holtz. This guy, I wish this guy was my grandfather. He is just the coolest guy. Crime on the Wayne State campus is down about 50% in the last several years. In fact, it almost rarely happens at all these days. The revitalization of Midtown is almost solely attributable to the fact that the Wayne State Police have basically taken over that little section of Detroit and made it their own. They have a 60-member force. They guarantee or they promise 90-second response time. Maybe, in a bad day, maybe 2 minutes, but they'll be there and they'll take care of the thing. And they're all, unlike your basic mental image of campus cops, they're all duly commissioned. They're sworn. They're peace officers. They're members of the Detroit Police Department in the same way that Detroit cops are. And they're just taking care of this. I did a ride-along with the sergeant of their crime abatement team. I spent some time with Tony Holt, who is just one of the funniest people I know. And the campus, that part, this is a section of Detroit that blows every conception people have about Detroit in the kisser. I mean, this is one of the safest. In fact, Wayne State was just named not long ago one of the 50 safest college campuses in America. And people go, how can that be? Well, it's because the police department is so dedicated on campus to making it safe, because they know that a lot of parents will think twice, three, maybe five times about sending their child to the middle of evil downtown Detroit. So the University of New many years ago, it had to overcompensate for that negative image, and they've done such an amazing
sounds
job.
Like you need to get wider distribution on that piece there. In the time remaining, I know you do things on Big Glowing Box, JK Just Kidding, of course. If somebody wants to book you as a speaker, retain you as a writer, or just kind of sit there and watch you eat pancakes, there's JimMcFarland.com.
All true, dude. Yes. And I eat pancakes.
True.
I've got things to mention.
Yeah, you are definitely accessible, available, and,
Oh, yeah.
I knew when I was finishing up the series, because I do podcasts now. I did 2 years straight and burnt out, and I looked at Oprah and I said, this woman only does 35 weeks a year. Why don't I learn from her example? So I'm pretty much going to finish this series out through June at some point, and then take a little time for myself. I don't think people, writers or producers or content producers, they don't realize that the well needs to replenish and then you can dip back into it. So,
yeah,
so any parting shots here?
I'm sorry.
I said any parting shots here before we go?
The parting shot is yes, Dean, I want to thank you for the job you've done. I think that your podcast is just outstanding. You've inspired me, and I know many others. You can't let the audience determine your life and your pace. I hope you take time off and recharge your batteries and come back to On the D's List stronger and brighter, if that's possible, and funnier, I don't think that's possible, and happier than before, because you provide a great
service.
There
are people who will argue that last one, funnier, yes. I mean, you know, trust me, I've seen a few joke books under the Christmas trees over the years.
Yeah,
it's
not that.
Trust me, I'm the king of left-handed compliments here, but it's about you today, and I wanted to make sure we got you in on part of this series, because I always feel time with you is time well spent. And by the way, next time you creep into town, I think you still owe me lunch.
I do.
Hint, hint.
And that will happen.
Hint, 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 as big as a whale. Oh, my dear friend, there's only one thing left to say, because I don't want the clock to go out on me here, and that's Jim McFarlane, Word Grouch, you are once again on the Dean's List.
Thank you, sir.
And that's where I got to leave it, my friend. All right. Thank you so much. The clock moves fast with time with you. And that's where I got to leave it here. I'm Dean Lattiser. Thanks for listening to On the Dean's List, the podcast where we definitely celebrate the art of conversation today. Jim's such a great guy, and I always enjoy spending time and hanging out with him. Make sure you tune to blogtalkradio.com/onthedeanslist. We'll have some upcoming guests here. Got a few more to finish out the series here, and then we'll take a little respite. Full disclosure here. But most importantly, I thank you for listening. Until next time, it's been this time, and thank you for being part of